Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you want to go to rugby heaven? Let's go back to 1987 with Squidge, with Squidge. Let's go back to 87 with Squidge.
And welcome to the final. We made it. We got through and reached the point in which we will never need, necessarily, to watch a rugby match from 1987 ever again, until we start a retrospect on the first of a premiership. I am joined, as ever, by Mr. Will Owen. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I mean, you say that. That's until we complete every World Cup and we go back through them again after that, which is definitely something we have in plan.
Look, we've got more men's World Cups to get through. We've got women's World Cups, if it was possible to get footage for games.
Yeah.
This is something we've talked about and gone over at length, but it's impossible to get hold of all the games to cover one.
It's certainly something in the future, if we can. Yeah, if we can get to one, that we will eventually do. But
if we ever get to that, if we ever get that desperate, we can cover Sevens World Cups.
If we get that desperate, yes.
Or we can cover rugby league.
What can we define as a World Cup?
It's a very good question.
Yeah.
But right.
World Club Cup, that's going to come into play.
One day, we can shove that in. We've done the Lions tour, you know, there's no rules.
It's true.
But, right, it was a question World Rugby were asking for many years. 1995, they finally went, yeah, right, we'll do a World Cup.
Yeah.
And 18 months later, they had one. They had one put together, and boy, has it been just as shoddily put together, but you can tell actually a lot of hard work went into it.
Sure.
As you'd kind of hope and expect.
I will also say, so you just introduced me there, that my name is Will Owen, as it happens. And because, as we both know, probably the majority of the audience of this podcast come just for me, okay?
Yes,
so for all of the people who are unaware, could you please introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm Robbie Osquidge, whatever you want to call me, from YouTube. You may have heard of that.
I also realised that if I was a good co-host, I would have introduced you, but
no.
I'm not.
No, you're not. No, I mean, no, you're not. No, you don't have to. What? No, it's fine, is what I meant. So, we are here today, and I am getting right into it, because there's a lot to get through. The final of the 1987 Rugby World Cup, right? And it's an amazing feeling, kind of getting there, right? Because when we watched the 2011 tournament, we kind of built up towards the final, and we're really excited about the final, and excited about that, because it's, we both love that game. Right, we watched it live together at the time in 2011.
We have great memories of it. We both recall sitting on the sofa and watching it together, and the drama of it, and the real intensity of it. And that was the overwhelming feeling, wasn't it? That we could really dig into it.
And it's a game I think we've both watched independently before watching it back for the podcast. We watched back, you know, in kind of 10 years intervening
for recreational purposes.
Yes. This game, on the other hand, I think we were looking at in very different terms. I think a part of us was, part of me certainly, was going, when we get to the final, I've never got to watch another bloody 1987 game ever again. But, right, when I finally sat down to watch it, my brain was going, I just thought I was going to be watching an old rugby match once a week for the rest of my life. I thought this was just how I was stuck in. I thought this was kind of like a purgatory I've made for myself, that I am stuck watching players knock it on and run bad lines once a week for the rest of my life. I'm kind of cursed by my own hubris. And yet, we've made it. We've got here to the final.
We've done it. That's it out the way. Now that we've made it to the recording of this podcast, we don't actually have to watch any of it ever again.
No.
How does that feel for you then? Do you generally feel relieved about it? Do you feel slightly nostalgic or poignant about it?
Yeah, I thought I would. But actually, I kind of feel like I have more to say and more to think on this 1987 Rugby World
Cup. I know what you mean.
And I think we kind of haven't covered it as thoroughly as we could have.
I know what you're saying. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One of them being that this World Cup is shorter than the previous one that we covered. This is, you know, about 15 games shorter or something like that.
So, yeah, so the original World Cup was... not the original World Cup. This is the original World Cup. The first World Cup we covered, being 2011, was 48 games. and we covered we did 48 games plus two retrospective kind of look back episodes as well, making it 50 episodes. Yeah. And this World Cup was 32 games, and so we did 33 episodes covering the 32 games that happened and one we made up.
Yes, absolutely.
And so, obviously, yeah, it leads into it being a shorter tournament. There's less time to kind of reflect on it, less time to talk through things, less time spent with each team, where they only played three pool games instead of four.
Yeah.
And knockouts are largely the same, but that's the only area that does remain the same.
That's it. But the thing is, you mention all of that. There definitely is more to be unpicked about this World Cup that we don't have access to, whether that's because it's not really on the internet or very well distributed on there, or because we're probably too young to know a lot about some of these players or some of these teams.
Yeah.
So that's why often our guests have certainly helped us. So firstly, I would like to thank them throughout this tournament.
Yes.
I don't want to stray too much into the territory of the wrap-up episode, which is going to come up after this. Mm. But, you know, we've learned a lot through the guests who have uncovered some information for us about certain players, teams, coaches, whatever. Or the state of generally, like, 1987 in New Zealand. But the interesting thing...
And marriage in New Zealand.
Exactly.
Know, big topic of debate.
But that's the thing. I think that generally... We've taken the piss out of this World Cup a lot more than 2011, which is why it feels like we've only just, you know, scratched the surface on the whole thing, because rugby hasn't been at the forefront, and that's fine.
Well, the semi-final between Australia and France, which is one of the greatest games ever played.
Phenomenal.
Is kind of the one episode where we've taken the game seriously.
Yeah, it
until
is.
Until now?
Yes.
Because I think... Now, spoilers, right? But actually, who cares? I think this game, I think this final, this was one of going into... At the start of the day, this was one of two Rugby World Cup finals I had not watched.
Mm.
I've never watched the 1999 final through all the way either.
Right. I've never seen 91.
And I've seen the rest. 91. It's all right. There's a reason we won't be doing it next. It's all right. Yeah, I've never seen 1999. That's my kind of like blind spot in general, that World Cup. That's the World
Yeah, I know about. Nothing about that. I think we have covered this. Same.
Yeah. Ben Tune scores in the final. Oh, I know that. He's going to be the key point that answer if you ever do World Cup final try scorers, if that ever comes up. But having now watched this, right, I'm going to say this game is a bit of a belter.
I love it. I think that other than that semi-final
you
addressed that we did with Paul Williams, I think this is probably my favourite game in the tournament.
I think so. I agree. I think this is my second favourite game of the whole tournament. I think this is fantastic.
It's brilliant. And there are other games I will have enjoyed, but I don't think, again, as you say, I don't think I've taken a test match this seriously and really kind of like micro-analysed it in my head as I've watched it in that way of you know, possession matters, territory matters, pressure matters. These players playing in these positions matter. You know, I've not sort of had a game that's forced me to think about that as hard as this one has, including that semi-final. Yeah.
I think this is the highest intensity game of the tournament by some distance.
I'd agree.
It's the one where you can
tell a lot's riding on it.
Yeah, both teams are really switched on and absolutely 100% going for it.
And as like every mistake, every time someone drops the ball, there is consequence to it. And we've often kind of gone like, oh yeah, well, there's like 50 handling errors per team per game in this World Cup. Whereas in this, it's like no, everything is a lot more carefully considered, and it really kind of paves the way for rugby in the future, I think. That way of thinking, you know, it's a World Cup final, so it's daft of me to say.
A period about two-thirds of the way through the first half where France are in their own 22 defending and they keep turning the ball over and clearing it.
Yeah. Right?
And there's a thing I've said repeatedly in this podcast, in this series, that defending was not interesting or exciting in 1987. It was kind of a necessity. It was a necessary part of the game, but it wasn't something you would enjoy as a fan.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a period of France defending in the first half here that is actually engaging.
It is.
But for very different reasons. Because basically, and I mean, we'll get onto the All Blacks tries, but most of them come through them actually managing to recycle the ball.
Mm.
And so you don't have the same style you have nowadays where a team will work through 20 phases and then you win a turnover and it's huge and it's great and you get to clear the ball. More because New Zealand would try something ridiculous and you think they're going to score and then France would put in the last ditch tackle or the ball would come loose or something and they'd be able to clear it. But then they'd only clear it as far as the 22 and they'd be on the defence again. And it kind of felt like quite a long period of pressure, even though they were turning it over and they were clearing it quite often.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a hugely engaging period of the game.
You're right.
Has not happened previously in this tournament, and you know, doesn't happen in the second half, but like it burst into life as like an interesting moment of defense during that game. I think it's fascinating.
You're 100% right that like France are constantly under the pressure, but there's so many times where they turn the ball over and you go, that is a really good bit of play. that they then turn it, and they're trying to like gradually inch New Zealand 5 meters further upfield with each clearing kick. Bearing in mind, you can only kick to touch, you know, in your own 22, but you can carry it back at this point. Yeah. So it's a really fascinating thing of like them trying to kind of figure out the kicking tactics as they go, and New Zealand then going, right, we'll go back up. And you're right, there's a real sense of kind of like push and shove between the two teams. Yeah. And yeah, I really enjoy it. I think that you're right. Every tackle really, really matters.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
and
great.
Where the, I think the knockouts in general, we talked about this in Australia's games in particular, Michael Lyon was outstanding.
Yeah.
Kicking has mattered in the knockouts of this World Cup, right? Kicking has really mattered.
Mm.
And the teams, New Zealand, Australia, two best kicking teams of the tournament, France probably third. And that kind of shows they became the three best teams of the tournament because they were kicking incredibly well.
Yeah.
And that's mattered as we got further and deeper into tournaments.
Definitely.
But, right, what I've noticed is there's something we've talked about before when we were talking about this World Cup as well, both, you know, on and off air, is that we don't really mention the forwards. Like, we don't really know what they're doing. And I said in one episode, like, the England pack in particular is a bunch of just, like, people whose specialism is just being a prick, and Brian Moore, who is a prick, but he can play rugby, you know? And kind of, we love Brian Moore and...
We do.
Lots of love to him this week, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think this was the game where I paid most attention to what the forwards were doing as well.
Definitely.
And
like, I paid attention to the French front row.
When, oh, mate, Pascal Ondaas we'll get on to. That guy is a legend.
I didn't realise he got involved from time to time.
What a hero he is. But yeah, so I think there's... Both packs produce players that will be properly a man of the match contention or something other than like... Something other than like token mentions, because I feel like I've got to mention forwards. You know,
that's where
forwards got most of the nominations in 2011, but it's been backs mostly here because it's so hard to tell
tens
what
and wingers and
doing.
Stuff. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
There's a thing that sometimes happens on this podcast where we talk about a few players for the majority of the thing, and then I will say my man of the match, and it's somebody we've mentioned like twice, and I go, "Oh wait, watching the game, he was who I decided was man of the match." And now I realise on this podcast, the people who are watching this, listening to this, haven't seen the game. And it sounds really stupid that I've given this person man of the match. And I kind of had a few of those dotted around this time. Because I was like, oh, I've not made many notes about, say, Gary Whetton, right? And that's not to say that he's not going to get man of the match, because he might. But I wrote him down on my shortlist, for instance. And I've picked a random name out there, right? Because that's happened with a lot of forwards on both sides. I think that's often, you know, players will play well and you write them down as like, oh, well, it's man of the match contention, you know? And you think like, oh, okay. Does that fit the spectacle of the podcast?
Yeah. And I think that's the kind of... that's kind of very meta as a conversation.
It is.
But I do think it's going to change how this one plays out as well.
Definitely.
Because I think there's a lot to get through. I think this is a... It feels like we slogged through an awful lot in those opening few games in that first half of the World Cup, that pool.
Those opening first games, like, you mean the first 29 games of the tournament?
You know, but the games like Australia, England... And, you know, a bunch... There's a load of those games that were just utter dog shit.
Yeah.
Was it Australia-Ireland? England-Wales was terrible.
I'll tell you what. I had something come up on my, like, suggested on the side of this game on YouTube where it was, like, England v USA. And I just looked at it and thought, I cannot remember that game. I don't remember that game at all. Also, Fiji-Argentina came up on the sidebar. And I do remember that game because that was our introduction to Super Boot. And it came up, it was uploaded by World Rugby as the Rugby World Cup 1987.
Yes, I think I mentioned that at the time.
I think you did,
I definitely noticed it.
But it fascinated me.
The Rugby World Cup.
Rugby World Cup. One day we should do a podcast dedicated to every game in the Rugby World Cup, I think.
Tell you what, right? Though, speaking of intros to the Rugby World Cup.
Oh, yeah,
right? I want to talk about, before we get into the game itself, we finally see the opening titles.
We do.
Of the World Cup.
Do you want to play the absolute banger that comes at the start of this coverage?
Please do.
Okay, here we go. So, bear in mind, these days we're used to the World in Union, which, as I say, is a banger, right?
They always do different covers of World in Union nowadays. They kind of have epic versions and epic kind of lead-ins and like emotional lead-ins and so on.
Yeah.
We had not seen over any of the previous 31 games or the one we made up any signs of the opening of this World Cup, and finally it plays. And listen to it. What an absolute certified banger.
It's a proper 80s anthem, this is.
It sounds so much like a SNES menu music song. Like an early, like a middling early video game. Yeah. And over this, right, they play some random clips, and they seem random. And there's someone that edits rugby videos, right? There are times when I'm watching a video, I edit a video where I just pull a moment and I go, yeah, that'll do. And I just put it in, right? It seems like the entire title sequence was made up of moments where they went, yeah, that'll do. Like, there's a bit of someone being ankle tapped and falling over short of the try line and trying to offload badly. There's a moment of someone, like, barely getting a kick away. Like, it's not. It's not compelling moments. They're not carefully selected as, like, the Six Nations intro ones are nowadays.
What I like as well is that each one is preceded by a country's flag coming up. But the country's flag doesn't necessarily correspond to the clip they're about to show.
They also
So there's a point where, like, a Tonga flag comes up, and then they show a Tongan running with a ball. And then a Namibian flag comes up.
No,
and you see
no.
Eric Schomp running with the ball.
I love they show a Namibian flag before Namibia's declared independence as a country. So I listed the countries that they show the flag of, right? Okay. I went back and watched this about five times because I'm obsessed with it.
Yeah.
Right? The countries they show the flag of are Australia, but it's so zoomed in, you can't quite tell if it actually might be the New Zealand flag, which I think is sneaky of them. So they can, you know, like, you don't know. If you're a Kiwi watching this, you go, you know what, that might be my flag. I'll take it.
It's neutral. They co-hosted it, so you don't mind.
Exactly. So they show the Italian flag, which... Fair enough, they're in the tournament.
They certainly are.
At this point, they've arguably put the teams from the opening fixture in terms of possibly New Zealand and Italy.
Yeah, okay.
They then put a Great Britain flag, like the Union Jack, which I suppose of them going, we've only got limited time, let's get four of the nations out of the way.
Yeah, yeah, let's wrap them up together. We've already done two for New Zealand and Australia. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So they've put three flags up and covered seven nations. Very smart.
Yeah. And with that, they then showed two clips of Scotland after GB, which is just like, that's the Union Jack, that's the people that please most, that's great. They then show the Canadian flag and immediately cut to Americans, which I suppose they've gone like, same thing, innit? Same thing.
It's better they do that than the other way round, because I think that to stereotype, the Canadian people are less likely to revolt.
Yeah. And also, it's novel, you know. I bet a lot of Canadians are used to being like, oh, are you American? Very few Americans just assume they're Canadian.
Yeah, that's true.
But then they show the Japan flag, right? And then, after that, they show a really, really zoomed-in American flag, where you can only really see the stars on the stars and stripes. So you can't really tell what it is. But I worked out, they just zoomed in super far on the American flag, over the top. So they didn't need to conflate them with Canada at all. And then, of course, they played the most bizarre flag, everyone's favourite flag, which is the IRB flag. And you have a moment of going, what's this nation? Then you realise, no,
phone
it's
up
my
Sam
favourite
Lana,
country.
Verify what flag it is.
It's my favourite flag, the International Rugby Board flag, the filleted fish logo, as they called it themselves, which they play out, they then fade out, and it says, World Cup Rugby.
Yeah, not Rugby World Cup, it's World Cup Rugby was the thing that struck me. With a really inflated ball on there as well.
Yeah.
Which I like the look of.
But then, right, it zooms out and we see the crowd. We see the huge packed crowd. So yes. Eden Park, where it's being played, at that point had a capacity of 48,000, right? 48,035 was the capacity. They reckon about 50,000 were in the ground that day.
Okay.
So when they show the crowd, you can see there's moments where people are just sat on the banisters. People are leaning against the sides. They have people sat on the steps. They did not bother to keep it to seating. Like, they just pack everyone into the ground they can. And I absolutely love that.
I was going to say, a few security guards definitely took tips that day. Somebody saying, I'll give you 20 quid if you just let me walk in. And they went, go on then, just don't sit in anyone's seat. That is probably what happened.
Yeah.
This was the 80s.
There's people against on the railings across the back just sat leaning on them, which is not safe at all.
No, of course
but
not.
But it happened. Funny you should say 20 quid as well. Yeah. Take a guess how much tickets cost for this World Cup final. They were all
20
one
quid.
Nope. Well, okay, they were adjusted for inflation, about £42 in British pounds now.
Okay, okay.
Which
That's
was
good.
The most expensive tickets of the tournament. But also, right, compared to the tickets for, I mean, this year's World Cup, the cheapest tickets go for about £92. So about £50 mm-hmm. more than twice the price. The tickets for 2015 World Cup started about £150 for the final. And that's actually pre-inflation. Yeah. I haven't checked where that is with inflation. So, you know, the value of the thing has gone up enormously.
Yeah.
But also, speaking
you
of crowds,
got your Rugby World Cup 2023 final ticket for about £700, am I right?
Oh, I think it's about 400. I think it's about 400.
Okay. I don't know where I pulled 700
I would have
from.
Paid literally any amount of money. Like, I'm just...
Yes.
It's like the top of my bucket list to go to a World Cup final.
You would have paid all the money in the world for that if you had it.
I would have stolen it personally from Carys Williams. Now she's declared for Wales, so I owe like half of it, yeah. I think, because I'm half Welsh.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's how it works. I get
you would have paid half the money in the world. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, I'm not giving all of it. Bloody...
Well, that's the objective of this podcast, for us to get half the money in the world.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and I'm not giving it all to Bernard Laporte. You know, like, you know what he's going to do with it.
He's going to shove it up his bum.
He will. He's notorious for doing that. You've got the previous chairman of the Rugby World Cup who used to wank over pigeons, and now the future president of World Rugby. And
every
of
time
French
you give him coin,
is
coin
he's just
ends
up his bum.
In an anus. Yeah.
He's just constantly shoving money up his bum. Someone stop him.
It's the one, it's his one downfall of Bernard Laporte.
Yeah, last year he was investigated by the French authorities.
In his anus. Yeah.
He was investigated by the French authorities for financial misgiving. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was for the fact he tried to shove an entire bank up his bum. And they were like, no, this still counts as bank robbery. Like, you committed a heist, technically. It doesn't matter that it's in your bum, you have no intention of spending it.
He was put into a disciplinary to explain all of this, and he denied it. But then he farted, and just loads of just euros started flying out of his trousers.
He's so thankful for contactless payment, because chip and pin was a nightmare for him. He got so many paper cuts.
This is
there's a delightful mental image for you. Yes. So, right, we were talking about the crowd for the Rugby World Cup final in 1987, the year. And... The other interesting thing I want to add here, right? So they estimated that the audience watching this for this game, right, was around 100 million. They estimated around 100 million people watched the World Cup final, which was broadcast around 6 a.m. French time, around 5 a.m. UK time. So, you know, like, a doable time, but not ideal.
Yeah.
Like, it was... Yeah, it wasn't 2 in the morning. It wasn't like a terrible time. It was really early on Saturday morning, and it was a World Cup final. So what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Yeah, but they estimated 100 million people watched that. In terms of the growth of the tournament, which is something we talked about a lot over this podcast, about how the tournament has just spiraled and grown and exponentially just expanded beyond what it was at this point. The point they kind of only had one sponsor in Stein Lager, but we saw
Stein Lager everywhere. We certainly did. Hey, I quite fancy a Stein Lager now you mention it.
Do you?
Should we go for one after this podcast?
I really fancy a Mitsubishi. Yeah, a Mazda. I really fancy a Mazda. I could really do with drinking a Mazda. Yeah.
Look, you have some petrol and I'll have some lager. We'll both end up in the same state.
Sam Lager. So they reckon around 100 million watched the 87 final, right? Around 857 million watched the 2019 final.
Wow.
So that's...
The thing is... Over 35-ish years, that's not, like, an insanely drastic difference to say how stupidly organised this tournament was.
Yeah. But it's basically, rugby has grown 8 times in popularity. In the course of the last 35 years, is basically what we're looking at. We've got a metric for that, essentially.
And that's a good stat, you know, that we can actually compare that, yeah.
The other thing is, it's quite hard to verify that. That was an estimate made before the game. They reckoned 100 million people were going to tune in. It's quite hard to get comprehensive figures for how many
I reckon 100 million people have listened to this podcast.
yeah. But I think they were basing on how many people were watching around the world and watching the other games and watching the semis and so on.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So on and so forth.
But, you know, I've looked at the stats of people who've listened to the old podcast. I don't really do that often. Occasionally I do.
Was it?
And that
has it grown
means...
around 8 times? Are we going to get around 8 times the listeners when we do 2019? Is that what we're saying?
That's the plan. That's the plan.
But the 100 million of that, they're estimating around 2 million people in New Zealand were going to watch this, which is an insane figure when you consider the population of New Zealand at the time, 1.5 million or something they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start looking at how the All Blacks treated this final, or how New Zealand is in general treated this final, you get a really, really drastic picture of how much things changed.
Oh.
And it's something we talked about with Jamie Wall on a previous episode, and we've kind of discussed in pieces around this World Cup that the New Zealand public had fallen out of love with the All Blacks, you know, over the early 80s. They were no longer the kind of beloved force they once were.
Mm.
And a lot of that was kind of them having rough periods. They had a countless number of scandals leading into the year before this World Cup, the infamous Cavaliers tour. For anyone unaware, the tour of South Africa that wasn't sanctioned by the New Zealand Rugby Union, by World Rugby.
Of course.
They weren't allowed to tour. They weren't allowed to tour under the name New Zealand or the All Blacks. So they toured under the name the Cavaliers. But they sent basically the New Zealand national team out to South Africa to play them. And it was a hugely controversial thing at the time. It was during the peak of apartheid.
Yeah.
And hence why South Africa weren't invited to this tournament.
Yeah, it would have been after the flower bomb incident that we've previously discussed.
Yes.
Which will have been a big reason, presumably, of why they thought, we can't go back there, this is too dangerous.
Yeah. And so, before this tournament, New Zealand kind of basically rebooted the entire team. Hence why there's such a young look to all of this side. They're largely kind of kids. And a lot of these players go on to play for a very long time after this. You know, you have players here who would go on to play in the 95, even 99 World Cups throughout this team.
Yeah.
Dotted throughout the entire thing. David Kirk, as the captain, kind of was that very, like, school head boy look.
Yeah.
And was kind of taken to heart as almost like, I think the best way, I think I've described him as this on a previous episode, but he's kind of like the boy you hope your daughter will bring home.
Yeah. Yeah. This was actually his penultimate game for the All Blacks, David Kirk.
Hmm.
So
what
he
was
retired.
His game?
He played Norsemen International after this.
Okay.
Because they had them in 1987, post World Cup, because they played the World Cup in May and June for whatever reason. This game was actually played on our mum's birthday. There's a fun fact for you.
Oh.
Anyway.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Do you want to look at the New Zealand team then?
Sure. Okay. So, I mean, New Zealand only make one change, which is they bring back in Michael Jones, who again, at this point, was a youngster who'd kind of been drafted into this tournament.
Yeah. I think he's probably one of the standout players in this tournament for New Zealand, and has been. And as you say, he's a young gun, but at this point they'll have gone, he's done enough to prove himself that he's worthy of starting above. They had Zinzan Brook, of course, play early in the tournament, but he was also very inexperienced at this stage. And Mark Brooke-Cowden, of course, played the semi-final for New Zealand. So otherwise, it's as you'd expect from the All Blacks. They've got the big guns. You know, you've got Fitzpatrick, you've got both Wettons, you've got Shelford all in the pack. Big legendary names of All Black rugby. Grant Fox stays in the 10 jersey, not that that was ever in doubt. Stanley and Taylor in the centres, who've played solidly all tournament. Kerwin Green and Gallagher, back three as well, who, again, their results have been excellent. So,
one note about this New Zealand team, right? We've talked all the way about how there's a huge theme of fathers of modern players throughout this team.
Correct.
Right? Throughout all the teams in this World Cup, right? I found out today that John Gallagher is Matt Gallagher's dad.
You're joking.
John Gallagher is Matt Gallagher's dad.
The Saracens, I did not know that until and Munster.
Today. Munster fullback. I had absolutely no idea that his son went on to play for Munster, Saracens, now Bath. Bless him.
The thing is, right, I never would have thought that's an extremely common name in rugby circles, right? Like, there's as many Gallaghers in rugby as there are in Oasis. And yet, I am very shocked to find out they're related.
Both play the same position. How did we not know this?
In fairness, I always thought Matt Gallagher was English/Irish. Because am I right thinking he's Irish qualified?
So is
John Gallagher.
So John Gallagher was born in London to an Irish father, then moved to New Zealand as a kid.
Okay.
And then, right, later on down the line, moved to New Zealand when he was a teenager, largely to play rugby, because he wanted to.
Right.
Went on to join the police in Wellington, became a policeman officer, and then became an All Black.
Mm.
And do you want the other great stat about John Gallagher?
Please.
Never lost a test match.
Wow.
Never lost a test match.
Blimey, that's a hell of a stat. How many caps did he get?
Played for the All Blacks for 6 years, never lost once, over a grand total of 41 games.
That's insane. That's surely untouchable by anyone at international level.
Oh, okay. He
passed up.
He played 41 games, but only 18 tests.
Okay.
So, still, it's one of those weird amateur era things.
Still, 18 games unbeaten is unbelievable.
Yeah. 41 full games as well.
Like, I'd be very surprised if another player in the men's game achieved that in the future.
Adam Beard got to like 16.
Yeah, but unbeaten. He didn't get to 18.
No, very close.
He then lost two in a row when he got there.
Fake news. John Gallagher then signed for Leeds in Rugby League and has lived in the UK since. Hence, Matt Gallagher growing up in England, playing under-20s rugby for England. Played in a World Cup winning under-20s team, actually. And then obviously is Irish qualified as well, as through his grandfather, who was John Gallagher's father.
Yes.
For some reason, that never came up. We never knew about that. Do you want another great fact about a member of the All Blacks team?
Go on.
Murray Pearce, right? The second row, okay? Retired from rugby, became an insurance person. Then retired from that and spent about 20 years doing stadium tours of Eden Park.
What?
So he went on to... He did the stadium tours of Eden Park. He became like... That was what he did. He was
an
All Black they hired to do stadium tours. And he would kind of wander around being like, you know,
I'm not
going to
lie.
I played in the World Cup final in my day.
Look, we've both done the Millennium Stadium Principality Stadium tour. You've done it twice. I've done it once. And I tell you what, that sounds a lot more engaging than Derek from Cardiff doing it.
Just
telling you about, oh yeah, and this is where Ross Moriarty laces his boots up. And instead this goes, oh yeah, this is where I won the fucking World Cup. Like, here's my winner's medal if you want to look at it.
He'd also do, like, tours for, you know, like, hospitality and for people that, like, paid a certain amount.
That's
they could
so
do, like,
cool.
A tour where he'd take them around and show them, like, stuff in various
That's
rugby cities where
the All
Blacks were playing.
Yeah. Having an actual All Black do it. It's like, oh, you get to meet this guy who won the fucking World Cup. That's so good.
And, like, by this point, you know, he was in, like, his late 40s or something, and he was kind of, like, a bit past his best and whatever you... But, like, was a kind of engaging and funny guy and could do that. Like, I bet that was a lot of fun. And I think he still does the odd one, but, like, it's not full-time anymore. Now he's in his 60s.
Yeah. But I'm not going to lie, when you first said he does stadium tours, I thought you meant in the way Ed Sheeran does stadium tours. I thought you meant... And then he said, of Eden Park, and I was going to say, that's not a tour. And then I realised that it was much more localised.
I love the thought of him going around, just holding his World Cup winner's medal and going, you're right, there you go.
Yeah.
Nice one.
Just does like a, you know.
Sells out.
35-year residency of Eden Park and nowhere else. And it counts
he
as a stadium
tour. He supports P-Money on tour.
Yeah. Hey, we should go to that.
We should get P-Money back and ask him about Murray Pearce someday.
But we should. We really should. Pearce.
Yeah. One day. We'll get him back.
One day.
Get him back.
Yeah. Not today, though.
So, yeah, it's a full full team of great, great people. Richard Lowe doesn't get on, he's on the bench, but both his daughters have now represented New Zealand in Olympic rowing, Jessica and Olivia.
Wow. So never knew that.
That's a cool little fact for you. Me neither. I did a lot of research onto this New Zealand team today, and it turns out a bunch of the players weren't playing, so I haven't got really a chance to talk about it that much. But that's a good one. Tell you what, right? Two very contrasting stories of players who didn't play much in this World Cup. Okay?
Right.
From looking at the wider 26-man squad that they had at the time, 26 was the squad size at the time, Albert Anderson, okay, who is the second most famous All Black to come out of Southbridge Rugby Club. Do you know who the first is?
Nope.
Dan Carter.
Yeah, fair enough.
They produced two All Blacks, one of which is an all-time great, and the other one did
both
also win the World Cup.
Yeah, exactly. He only played one game, but he still won a World Cup, so fair play.
Yep. He played just the one game against Fiji in this World Cup, went on to play for them against Australia in the following tour the next year, eventually retired with six caps. But when asked about his time at the World Cup, he said, well, someone had to drink all the Stein Lager they were supplying us.
My man. Well, I'm writing him down as player of the tournament contention.
However, right, complete opposite end of the spectrum in terms of approaches to not playing, Bruce Deans,
okay,
who died a few years ago of cancer, aged 58, which is horrible.
Oh, that's horrible. That's awful.
Yeah, which is tragic and, But he was the second choice scrum half, kind of understudy to David Kirk. Didn't get to play because they played Kirk in every game because he was kind of, you know, the key man and he was kind of the focal point of the team and so on.
Yeah.
But did go on to play again and went on to coach the USA national team as well after retiring.
Okay. That's nice.
But yeah, he said that he felt it was his job to push the other guys to be the best they could be and for me to be the best team man I could be. And
that's good. We like that.
He said he was really proud of his role within the team and he felt like he really did contribute even though he didn't get on the field, which I think is amazing.
Fantastic.
That's really cool. Like,
that's brilliant.
It's something we've talked about a lot.
That's kind of a good rugby player.
Yeah, like the great Lions who don't play a test match, you know? It's the equivalent of that.
Yeah. And in a World Cup where you're not allowed non-enforced substitutes, that is the exact equivalent.
Exactly. And he really, really did that. And he really, really, as he said, you know, was very
that's
happy
brilliant
about how he contributed.
We'll come on to it, but at the end of the game, David Kirk does say thank you to all of the wider squad members. As I said, this is a whole squad effort, which is nice because it wasn't. But I'm joking, obviously. But it's really cool knowing that there are people like that who did genuinely pull their weight despite not getting on the field.
And of the All Black coaches, while we're going through this team, right?
Mm.
Brian Lahore, the head coach, who died just before the 2019 World Cup.
Yeah,
but at
legend.
The far riper age of 78. Yeah, head coach, World Cup winner, first World Cup winner, as well as captain the All Blacks between 1966 and 1970.
Yeah.
He also went on to, as well as chairing the Hillary Commission of Sporting Agency, he also was still a selector involved in the All Blacks in the Graham Henry era. And eventually retired from being involved in rugby in 2011.
Fair play.
That's how long
I mean,
he
it is a little bit Jobs for the Boys-ish, and I love it.
Yeah. But he... so
again, it's like the fact they're clinging on to Graham Henry still.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, so he was head coach for another few years after this, but he remained involved with the All Blacks for another 24 years.
Blimey.
Which is mad. Whereas,
that's
right,
a strong innings.
Yep. Whereas his assistant coach, Alex Wiley, right, who is now 77, okay, went on to replace Lahore as head coach in 88 the following year, after Lahore retired but still remained involved.
Yeah.
The All Blacks played really, really well. He coached them until the 91 World Cup, where when they got knocked out, he got moved aside. And he then went on to coach Argentina in the 1999 World Cup, where they famously knocked out Ireland. In what round would it have been where they knocked out Ireland? I don't know.
Was it the semis? No.
Something like that.
Quarterfinals, I think. Quarterfinals.
Quarterfinals.
Something with final on the end.
It happened, yeah. However, right, after retiring from coaching after that a few years ago, he took up a new sport in lawn bowls. Right?
What?
And he went on to not just start playing lawn bowls, but start playing lawn bowls competitively. To the point in which, right, he was the key player in the Woodland Jets winning the televised event, right? The New Zealand Bowls 5 National League Final, which was broadcast live on National Kiwi TV.
Blimey.
Alex Wylie, well, the former All Blacks coach, went on to become a National Standard Bowls player in his 70s.
And that's the cue after the Rugby World Cup.
Yeah.
We're gonna cover it eventually. That's remarkable. A man of many, many talents. It might just be two talents, but he's very good at the pair of them.
Yeah. Yeah. The other assistant coach, John Hart, went on to, again, coach the All Blacks as head coach in 1999 for that World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
He then went on after that to become involved in New Zealand golf. And he's now a high up in New Zealand golf organisation.
Wow.
So that is quite a comprehensive guide to the All Blacks that I felt like I wanted to give because I did a lot of research and I think it's worth talking through. Do you want to talk us through the French team?
Yes. So as they come up on the broadcast, the commentator, and again, this is Keith Quinn and Curtin that we've got here on the comms.
Yes.
They decided to bring up that France have actually gone for a very strong team in this game. Yeah, no shit. I will stress as well, before reading out this French team, I'm very much of the opinion that these are the two best teams in the tournament that we have in this final.
I completely agree.
And I'm really glad to see them play against each other. There's a real clash of styles and it's great. But yes, so the French pack is huge. And so we'll kind of enlightened as we go on to Ondars, De Broca and Lamperou in the front row. Elik Schomp is a real imposing figure in the back row as well. Laurent Rodriguez has played well in the pool stages.
I love Elik Schomp because he is not the image, the model hard man in rugby, right?
He looks like Bob Ross.
He has like this like thick mop of curly hair and he's got skinny arms and he's kind of like not that imposing a figure. He's like, he's quite tall.
He's got quite a cute looking face.
Yeah. Like he's,
and like
he's
he like tries kinda to look threatening, but he has just quite a sweet face.
He looks like he wouldn't be out of place in an Eric Rohmer movie, like as the best friend who finds out like his friend's being cheated on. You know, like he's got kind of like he's got the energy of someone who's really like. There's something like I would believe it if I looked at him and found out he played World of Warcraft.
Yeah, yeah, I believe that even in 87 in France.
Yeah. Famously, they don't do World of Warcraft in France. It's called World de Warcraft. No, that's what it's called in the Netherlands. Okay, but here's the thing about Elik Schomp, right? He does not give off hard man energy at all to glance at him. And then you see him square up to, like, Buck Shelford. And he's suddenly terrifying.
Yeah,
like, he's
a
man who is scary only in aura. Like, he has this, like, horrifying aura the moment he wants to give it off. But he is not threatening at all to glance at it. Like, if you saw a photo of him, you would not believe that is one of the all-time great rugby hard men. And yet, to see him play, like, they cut to him join the Hacker before this game. And you're almost like, he is scarier than the War Dance. Like, seeing that man once.
He's like a weeping angel. Once you're in contact with him, oh, shit, this is life-threatening here, rather than just something that's staring at me.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, quickly, the French back line. You got Blanco there. They leave in Didier Campbell and Bello on the wing, which I'm really glad of. He really deserves it. He's played well in the whole World Cup. Sellat, of course, in the centres. And then they stick with Maynel at fly half.
Yeah.
Accompany Bebezier.
Well, Maynel feels like the kind of big call to me. You know, Guy Laporte had played very well over the tournament. Played in the semi-final. The quarter-final. Yeah. Played really well. Then got
dropped. Didn't even make the bench, Laporte.
No. Really, and they just dropped him out of the team entirely.
Yeah, he played very well all tournament, I think, when he was in.
Yeah, I feel like that's quite a controversial decision. That is kind of the big call there. Otherwise, it's largely as was. You know, they largely stick as they did.
Yeah.
We have the one other change, I guess, from the semi-final in that pack is Jean Condom comes back in, who'd had a bit of a niggle and missed the semi and quarter-final.
Yeah.
So he comes back into the team, which is, I think,
too
a big
important
relief
to play
for a lot of players.
Take the risk on. I think with Maynel, I don't think he has a bad game, but I think if they were allowed, they would have subbed on Laporte for him in the second half.
Yes, yeah.
Because, like, they will have needed somebody to just really, like, just grab the game. And Maynell didn't quite do that in the same way Grant Fox did. And you would have actually wanted to roll the dice in a World Cup final on that a little bit. As I say, he didn't play badly by any stretch, but I think that's kind of my assessment on what would happen in a modern game where they could have, where they had the option to do that.
And in the case of injury, they had Pierre Bebezier, the scrum half, covering, who, as he was known, le directeur du jouer. Of play.
Yep. They gave him a lot of nicknames through this game, the commentators.
Yeah.
There was a lot of them in multiple languages. It was fascinating.
Rodolphe Maudin, who really impressed in the one game he played and the one game that didn't exist, stays on the bench. Obviously never goes on to play for France again after this. We didn't get the Jean-Marc Doussin situation as them shoving him on anyway.
Cowards. Pure cowards.
Absolute cowards.
You were about to talk about the hacker. So, before the hacker has even started, Keith Quinn says on the comms, okay, this is a really exciting moment. The All Blacks are about to do the hacker, and France, the absolute fucking madmen, are about to challenge them. So clearly somebody had told the commentary team, by the way, France are going to challenge them. This hacker isn't going to be done unopposed, right? And we've covered in the 2011 final, France challenged the hacker. So for those who have forgotten or those unaware, they started off holding hands in an arrowhead formation and then walked up to the halfway line. And New Zealand obviously absolutely shat themselves at that prospect. However, if you think that was...
walking forwards.
Exactly. If you think that was a challenging opposition to the hacker, wait till you've seen what's happened on this one. Because it was them standing a respectful 20 metres away up to where the legal line probably is, apart from Eric Schomp, who then walks three steps forward and tries his best to look threatening, but he's got too sweet a face for it to be really that bad. And the rest of them look slightly timid, and the All Blacks don't notice.
No, but I think there is something in the fact that actually, when you look at that team as they do the hacker, right?
Mm.
France stands a united line. If you look at virtually every other team, they just kind of stand and they watch. And like Italy in that opening game did not line up. They did not work together. Wales were just kind of stood about. Like France stand up and they stand
together.
I do
agree.
And they go, we are challenging you. We are.
They make a point on the comms of the fact that they all like made eye contact with them as they did it.
Yes.
Rather than just spectating. It was like, no, our heads are up. We don't look away from them. Almost like we're meeting the hacker. We're respecting the hacker rather than just we're observing it. Which, I guess, in translation, that is a challenge, as it were. It's just funny because you compare it to, like, the Wales iconic standoff and the Wallabies warming up and getting absolutely pumped afterwards.
I think it was the start of that. You know, it's kind of the first time someone did that. Like, this is obviously, this tournament is the first time New Zealand performed the hacker at home, right, on home turf. Like, it was not that common, it wasn't the kind of fixed point in rugby that it is now.
Yeah.
And so seeing France stand and challenge it, and seeing Eric Schomp, my sweet potato pie, stare it down, and as I say, hold eye contact with the All Blacks, is a great moment. And I think that is... I think this is also the best hacker of the tournament, and probably the best hacker, considering they were pretty much taught to do the hacker properly before this tournament. It was kind of a matter of pride. They were taught in this year and a bit the year beforehand to do the hacker because they were doing it for the first time in New Zealand rather than overseas where kind of no one really cared. It was kind of like, oh, look, the novel thing. They did the little dance. Now it's like, no, we need to respect the culture this comes from.
Mm.
And also it was led by players like the Wettons and Buck Shelford and so on wanting this to be taken seriously and teaching them the hacker and making them learn it properly. I think this is, up to this point, up until 1987, the best hacker there's ever been.
Probably. I would need to go back and verify with all of the other hackers that have ever happened up to this
point. That's what we do instead of this tournament. We go back and do a hacker retrospective.
Yeah, all right then. All right. But yeah, no, I do agree with that. And as you say, like, it's not like Schomp was going to go up and smack David Kirk round the chops as a challenge, was it?
No.
And so they had to start somewhere, see what they could respectfully get away with, and then pave the way for other teams to go push the rules slightly further from there on out.
Yeah.
And that is cool in itself. It's the first time anyone's ever done this, as you say.
I'm a huge fan of Earl on the commentary, Earl Curtin, our best friend, saying, of course, the key man to watch for France is then listing five players.
He wasn't wrong, though. He said, like, Blanco, Sella, Champ, Condom, like Verbezier, or something like that, you know. He named five good players, so...
The other really cool thing about the lead into this game, right? They have a helicopter over the stadium. Filming.
I could hear the helicopter all game. It was where the aerial view was coming from, right?
Yeah. They have a helicopter with them. Like, super old school. Like, before they had spider cams and before they had drone cams and everything.
Yeah.
They had a helicopter filming the game, hovering above.
For the first time ever, there is a bird's eye view on Eden Park. So nobody's ever seen Eden Park from that angle before.
No birds have ever been over Eden Park.
No, there was a lot of birds on the field.
Some birds come around the second half.
Yeah. There was a lot of them. There was a proper pitch invasion of seagulls at one point.
Dominic Bird didn't exist yet. He'd never been to Eden Park.
I'm afraid not. But, of course, we're not far away from the kickoff now, right? And there is a moment where I get a little bit nostalgic and I go like, oh, you know what? This World Cup, as much as it's been shit, it's been all right, you know?
The amount of times
we thought like, oh yeah, crazy shit happens. You know, we've had Fabio Ring on the field and stuff. We've had like people knocking each other out. We've had the Constantine brothers. We've had like shit players that have been really funny to take the piss out of. We've had players who've been shit and then actually turned out to be world class. And I had a moment where I was really nostalgic. And not one second later... did this piece of commentary start?
Well, I've heard of a dog on the field, but this time we have a rooster on the field at Eden Park before the Rugby World Cup final.
And I thought, holy shit! Because he said, well, I've heard of a dog on the field. And I was like,
Dude, that's what I was thinking!
No!
Can we read out our notes in sync as per tradition? Okay?
Okay.
One... 2, 3. Rooster!
Oh, shit! Rooster on the pitch!
On the pitch! It happened!
And then I've got... there's a fucking chicken playing in the Rugby World Cup final!
Chicken just runs onto the pitch with, like, the French flag draped around its ankles. Like, tied to its legs, they've got the French flag.
Like, there's... when I was thinking about all this nostalgic shit, right, I was thinking, like, oh, yeah, but it's the final. Right, so
yeah,
I need to get that out of my head because I'm just watching a Rugby World Cup final. This in itself is iconic. I need to leave all that shit about dogs in the past for an hour and a half while I watch this, right?
Yeah,
I need to just think
about
the fact this is the Rugby World Cup final. And then when the commentary of the game, of the entire game, starts with the sentence, well, I've seen a dog on the field, I got so excited. And then this little fella
I couldn't believe it.
You could not.
And that's the great thing.
You can hear him on the microphone as well.
The chicken, yeah.
The chicken on the microphone. Going, bark.
And, like, he just runs around the pitch for a while. He just runs around the pitch. He just has a little nice go, like, running around the French team, wishing them all luck. It's like how they have a visiting dignitary from New Zealand Rugby Union, and then also the president of the International Rugby Board, both come out and shake everyone's hands. And then they have a chicken to represent France.
Yeah, exactly. It's just for equality. It's that great point where there's... like, all of the officials are meeting in the middle, and they all have this, like, elaborate handshake, you know, the touch judges and referees, like, oh, yeah, this is a big moment. And the commentators are saying, like, oh, this is great, you know, seeing all of this. And the referees are then clearly going, like, well, we have to wait for this chicken to come off the field first. Of course, with this all in mind, should we give the chicken a name?
We've got to, haven't we? Well, it's very, very obviously a French chicken, right?
Literally
it's got
a
the French flag
on. Yeah.
Yeah, it's tied to its leg, you know? Yeah. Like, it is so French.
Unbelievably French. The thing that I think about this, because obviously that's a very deliberate thing, that it's come as, like, a symbol of France, right? Is this an actual Kiwi chicken, or have they flown this chicken over from France? What do you reckon?
I wonder that, because it's clearly brought in by a French fan, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's clearly a French fan has gone, I'm going to sneak a chicken into a game. This has happened countless times since...
It has,
there's been countless
other
examples of chickens getting into.
Yeah.
And it's not certainly not the last. It happened in 2007 World Cup as well. Like it happens. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it happened in another game in this tournament, actually. They got a chicken into the ground. I'm pretty sure that's come up. But, you know, the chicken doesn't get onto the pitch in the World Cup final. You know, that only happens once, as far as we know.
Yes, we've got a lot more World Cups to cover. I was really, really caught by surprise when there was a chicken on the field. And he was rampant.
Yeah,
he was just running around like people trying to gather him up.
Yeah, so basically, he runs on, and someone in chinos chases after him a bit. And then he does a circle round them, and runs back, and a guy tries to kick him.
A guy tries to trip him up!
Yeah!
A guy just sticks his leg out, trying to leg up a chicken! And the chicken's just like, nah, mate, I'm having none of that. There's a proper Shane Williams-style hurdle of the ankle tap. And just cracks on, carries on running down the sideline.
If you pause it right before the chicken disappears out of shot, right before he runs off and they cut away, right? There is a guy dressed in a suit the colours of the French flag. And what's the betting that's the guy that snuck him on? Like, you can just about see that guy. They're all chasing the chicken. Round, and like, this is the halfway line they're on. Like, they're chasing the two teams are stood on the sidelines waiting for them to get this chicken away from the spot where he'll kick off.
Yeah, because those two teams are there like, we're here to win the Rugby World Cup. And then there's somebody on the sideline going, oh no, there's a chicken on the field. We didn't possibly plan for this to happen.
And like, what, when it cuts back to the referee, Kerry Fitzgerald, who is stood there kind of waiting, he is staring at the sideline waiting for the chicken to be off the pitch so he can go over and tell Grant Fox he's allowed to kick off.
The Rugby World Cup final, I will stress. It's phenomenal.
It's very good. But then the best bit, final. To jump ahead a bit, right? The chicken comes back!
He does.
In the second
half.
Very
brief in his return, yes.
Yeah. He immediately gets caught by a steward who carries him off under one arm as he's kind of flailing under his arm.
So somebody did a short-term fix and got him briefly off the pitch, but not exactly under control.
He went off for a HIA and then came back on.
At some point, someone probably got a disciplinary about the fact that they'd done the whole animal control thing, then took their eye off the chicken to watch the rugby, turn around and go, oh shit!
The chicken's back on the pitch. Tom, you had one job, and it was to make sure there were no chickens on the field during the Rugby World Cup final.
And that's it.
And I can't believe you failed twice!
I have a point really in my notes in the second half. We've seen a really intense bit of the game. And I've put France in their own 22. New Zealand attacking well. France give away a penalty. Oh, the chicken's back. Grant Fox lines up a kick and go.
But that's it. The commentators are like, oh, the chicken's back. Grant Fox not distracted by that chicken. Clearly not a true fox. Otherwise he would have been. He would have chased after that chicken all day.
Like somebody should have on the sideline, but I'm very glad that they didn't, you know. I'm really, really grateful for the really poor animal control department at Eden Park in 1987.
Bring this back.
Yeah,
I want a turtle on the pitch in 2023.
That's it. We've both purchased tickets to that final. If there are no animals on the field of play at any point, I'm going to be very, very disappointed.
Yeah, and like Dewey Lake doesn't count.
No, that's good. Yeah, I'm again just blown away by the fact this happened in the final. But I love it. More of it.
I absolutely, absolutely love it. And this leads us towards the kickoff for the Rugby World Cup final 1987, the very first one.
An iconic moment as Grant Fox kicks the ball off for the first time. And the commentators say, like, oh yeah, you know, I want you to take in this moment. And so I did. As he kicked it off, I paused and thought, this is cool. There's a chicken on the sideline.
Yeah.
And I pressed play.
And you know what? You forget about the chicken pretty quickly.
You do.
As we said, this is a really good game.
Great game. Great game. That was why
it somehow managed to overshadow the chicken on the pitch, which we didn't name. We didn't name Jean.
Jean the chicken.
Jean the chicken.
There we go. Very easily done. Very
Jean
easily
Chicken.
Done. Jean Chicken. Is poulet the French for chicken?
Maybe? No. Yeah, but his name's Jean Chicken.
Yeah. Just
you
Jean
wouldn't ask
chicken
me like, oh yeah, like oh, is it the French for human? If you're talking about human, no. Like his name's Jean Chicken.
It's a good point. I never asked what Italian for dog is.
Did
I?
Eye. No.
Anyway, so yeah. Grant Fox kicks it long. Maynell gives quite a shoddy reply to the first kickoff, if I'm completely honest.
Yeah.
But first lineup's thrown not straight, so it's no trouble. And this is where it begins, the whole back and forth thing of France winning a set piece, clearing it long.
So I think something interesting about that first line out. As you said, we went in, I certainly went in, I think you said the same thing, far more analytical than we have in other games. And you could feel the intensity. And I think the crowd being so huge and so loud.
Yeah, it was a great crowd.
And Earl Curtin said he'd never heard Eden Park this loud.
Mm.
And you have the same thing coming through all the All Blacks when you read them, you know, in autobiographies and interviews and so on since, all saying it's the loudest and the biggest crowd I ever played in front of, all talking about how huge an occasion it was.
Yeah.
And you kind of feel that, and that tunes you into the game so much more, that kind of sense of occasion that this game really had. I noticed that first line out, right? Both teams lined out in exactly the same order. So it's closest to the touchline, 1, then 4, then 5, then 8, then 6, then 7 at the tail.
That's
both teams'
really
numbers
satisfying.
Exactly the same, marked up. Exactly the same. As you say, goes not straight, leads to a scrum, and France smash it.
Yeah, they absolutely murder them at scrum. And this is sets a bit of a precedent at this point, you think.
Mm.
France are taking absolutely no shit from New Zealand. Like, as soon as they clear the ball and New Zealand try running these fancy moves, they very early on run one where it's a switch in midfield with Joe Sandy coming, like, on the angle, like, at pace. And against most teams, he would have ended up with an arm tackle and breaking straight through. And instead, France just go, no, you can't just run a move that simple and get through us. And they do that, and then like they win the ball back straight away from literally first phase, clear it again, and New Zealand then go, okay, I see what you're doing. You can defend that. Try Kerwin, you knobs. And they had no trouble. They defended John Kerwin. And it's like, holy shit, they deserve to be in the final.
Like, hold on, we're gonna need to try putting a fullback into the line now. See how that goes.
Yeah. And unbelievably, they would have been wise to it.
Yeah. I mean, second half they do, and they managed to defend it. They did, Second half. Early second half, it's in the first half. It's actually in the first half.
That's crazy.
They do try that, and Craig Green knocks it on. Like, they cover it.
Oh, yeah, of course. One where Craig Green hits that line and passes into touch as well.
Yeah. They cover this. They are switched on.
They're streetwise.
Now, this is an interesting thing.
Yes.
Because Philippe Seller has said since, I said this a few years ago in an interview when talking about the World Cup final in 87, he says he feels the biggest mistake France made is how they prepared for the game that day. Okay? So where the All Blacks left
the
team hotel...
Smashed?
No, they didn't go for Wales. Basically, the All Blacks, from the quarterfinals onwards, have been staying with families. They've been staying with, like, small families, and that was a deliberate thing they'd done in order to kind of reconnect with the New Zealand public, which is something they really were desperate to do after the kind of few years leading into this.
Okay, interesting.
So this younger team, and it was something that the coach, Brian Lahore, had kind of masterminded as such. Like, Sean Fitzpatrick referred to it as a masterstroke.
Mm-hmm.
So something they'd done, was that they started doing all their training sessions at schools, instead of doing them on kind of private fields and so on in rugby clubs. They start doing them all on school pitches so that kids can come and watch them, come and connect with them and like sign autographs and so on afterwards.
Right.
Which I think is a really cool, really simple idea, but really connected people to them.
You just need to really hope that there's no like spies in there or team analysts who could, you know, figure out like, oh, lefto means they go left, you know, and stuff like that.
Yeah. 1987, there was no analysis going on.
No.
We just actually performed the first analysis on a 1987 rugby match ever.
Holy shit.
So after the game against Argentina, before the quarterfinal in Scotland, instead of just going straight, they were due to fly straight to Christchurch, which was the play in this quarterfinal. Instead, they got the bus and they would stop off each day. And they kind of went it far more slowly and went in kind of increments and trained in schools all across the country. And they did that through the semi-final and then through the week leading into the final until the last few days when they all stayed in a hotel together. And instead of staying in a hotel for a whole week, they put them up just with random families. So Sean Fitzpatrick talks about how he stayed with the McDonald's. Him and Richard Lowe went and stayed with the McDonald's family for 3 days with the mum, dad, the kids, and they would just spend
meanwhile,
the night with them.
Meanwhile, Ondott stayed in McDonald's.
Yes. So they would just spend one or two nights at a random family from New Zealand's house who would volunteer. Mm-hmm. And it kind of became like a really great way of them connecting with the nation, people feeling really like this is our All Black team and they kind of really speak for us.
And our All Black is playing in there, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Like he stayed with us a few weeks ago and now he's playing in the World Cup final with a chicken.
Yeah.
And it kind of led to this like real sense of connection with the nation. And it's something David Kirk, like countless All Blacks, Grant Fox talked about this as well, that kind of they left the team hotel that morning of the final and the streets were lined with about 500 people waiting outside the hotel, waiting outside the hotel to see them get on the bus. And then the entire way the entire way to the stadium, the streets were lined with people cheering and clapping and
That's
applauding.
Fantastic.
And Grant Fox said on that team bus was the most nervous he's ever been in his life.
Oh, he to be fair, felt... it's awful.
Yeah.
Like, we've gone and done that again with Wales, where we've gone and seen the team bus coming past. And every time, like, they have blacked out windows, typically. But if you can see a slight silhouette through there, you can tell that they're shitting themselves.
Yeah. Some of them. It depends on the player, but...
Of course.
Grant Fox said he was generally quite laid back, but he felt himself dry heaving and almost throwing up before that.
Oh my God. Wow.
On the bus there. He said the moment he arrived and got into the changing room and got into his kit, he was fine, and he felt really laid back and like comfortable, like it was just another game. But on the bus, he felt this like huge weight of a nation. He'd never seen New Zealand like
Man.
This. And he'd never seen cheering and so on like this outside the ground. And like lining the whole route through, cheering and shouting at the bus and cheering them on. And other things like they'd... Lahore had also like encouraged them to just go to the pub and hang out with locals and sing songs and stuff.
Yeah.
And just like wherever they went, just like go and have like two beers and sing songs with locals to kind of connect with people. And like, and it just led to this like absolute fever pitch, like ridiculous level of hype and
just love for the All Blacks.
Genuine support.
Yeah.
Yeah. And love for the All Blacks.
Like supporting your local team at that point, isn't it? Yeah. Rather than the national team.
And that's what they turned them into. They turned them into like a beloved club team for the entire nation through all of this. And as I said, it led to like people sneaking to the ground and sitting on the steps and sitting on the railings and stuff instead of
I have to say, yeah, in the amateur era when love is lost for the All Blacks, Sean Fitzpatrick's bang on, that's a masterstroke by Brian Lahore to pull the strings of the nation to get his team to make his team a big deal again, you know? That's brilliant. That's fantastic. Extreme risk as well, I will say.
Yeah.
Massively paid off.
Buck Shelford said when he was kind of seeing the people, like 500 people outside the hotel, he thought, we're winning today. There's no way we lose this. We've kind of this like behind us.
Yeah.
The whole nation flooding through. And at the end, Grant Fox, at the end of his speech afterwards, he said, I'd like to thank all of you, New Zealand. And you know what? They contribute here.
They certainly
do. They really get behind them and contribute.
Certainly do.
France, on the other hand, the day of the final leading into this kickoff, right? They got together. They came to the stadium early and they sat apparently very close. I think it was like they've met somewhere really close to the stadium or it might have even been the changing room. And the whole team sat around for about 2.5 to 3 hours and they talked through what this meant. They went into some depth. They all got incredibly personal. And Seller talks about, you know, he it was the first time he'd really talked in detail about like his upbringing and his family and his wife and everything to his teammates. And all of them talked through like what their motivation and what this would mean and what this means to the nation and to the family and the people they grew up with, what this could lead to. And they spent, almost 3 hours. All of them went through in as much heartfelt detail as they could, opening up on the greatest possible level to...
I do kind of love that.
To each other. Yeah. And Philippe Seller says that now, having had 20-odd years to think on it, this was, I think, 2015 he talked about this. He says, having had 20-odd years to think on this, I think that was the biggest mistake we could have made.
Right.
Because it meant we went into the game so emotionally charged.
Yeah, really vulnerable.
That we weren't focused.
Yeah.
And he said that we just, like, if you look at it, we were, like, anything that required emotion. So what we were saying about them covering John Kerwin and being everywhere in attack, no, in defence, that was spot on because they were emotionally charged as they could possibly be. But anything that required accuracy, they were not focused. They couldn't hit at all.
Interesting.
And Seller said we were completely right to have done that. We should have done it on the Thursday or maybe the Friday.
That beforehand. If they'd done this the day before, then that's brilliant. Because I think that's really, really cool. The fact that they all opened up to each other and that they all recognised each other's motivations and, you know, they could really connect on that personal level and fight for each other. But you're right that it's great if you can hear that from everybody else. But when you have to speak it as well on the same day, which unbelievably everybody had to, because that's just the way it works, then you then become vulnerable hours before kickoff.
Yeah.
You're right. If that was done on the day before or in the middle of the week, then that would have, again, been something of a masterstroke, you know. You think about Razzy Erasmus's Springbok team that went and won in 2019.
Yes.
Very much a similar situation. that it was very clear to everybody by the knockout stages of what everybody's motivation was. You know, you look at Makazole Mpimpi, Sia Khaleesi talking about the townships and everything, Rossi Erasmus talking about them and their motivation and how much that personally affects him, how much respect he has for those players. It's great that, I think that generally great teams are supportive of each other in that kind of respect.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But yeah, the fact that somebody has to do it on the day of the Rugby World Cup final to learn that that's not the best idea to do it on the day of the Rugby World Cup final, right?
Yeah.
So I don't blame France whatsoever for that. I think that's a great way of preparing generally, but Sella is correct that maybe give it 24 hours.
Yeah. Didier Camembert-Barbera, I also read talking about this, and he said a similar thing of he felt the team went in just far too emotional. He said he felt the biggest mistake they made was that they tried to play the same tactics they played in the semi-final rather than approaching the All Blacks personally. The semi-final went so well. We used the same tactics we used for the Wallabies rather than changing things up. But he said other mistake was we were far too emotional. His wife was pregnant at the time when he went to France, when he went to New Zealand.
Oh, okay.
And he felt very guilty going over in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, but it can't be an easy decision, anyway. Can it?
No. Flew over, took part in the tournament, played really well, came back, and apparently again, he hadn't told most of his teammates how shaky and nervous and everything he was and guilty he was about his wife until they had that session and they talked about that.
Yeah.
And he was really open about that and talked about it.
Wow.
But it's not the only thing involving Didier Camembert-Barbera that came out this week.
No. Yes. So
news broke in New Zealand the day before this involving that man.
Yes. Didier Camembert-Barbera this week came out as bald.
Yes.
Which in itself is quite a funny concept. But it came out that he had had a hair transplant. He was previously bald and extremely self-conscious of image. It's very image conscious.
Mm.
And so I'm going to explain two sides to this from my perspective, and then I'm going to ask for yours, okay?
Okay.
On one side, it is funny. The way this explained.
Yes.
Because Keith Quinn says, some of us have known about this for a while. He's very, you know, he's been very conscious about talking about this. But he's actually bald. And it's just like, oh, okay.
But this is
I was thinking, it's the 80s. It would have been a big deal if it was like, oh, yeah, he's gay. Or something like that, which is what it's built up to be.
That's genuinely where I thought the sentence was going.
Me too.
And my brain
me
was
too.
Going, well, I would have heard about this if he was gay. You know?
Yeah.
And Alfie was the first professional player ever in a team sport to come out while still playing. But I was thinking, well, it was amateur era, so does that not count? Was Camembert-Barbera gay? Is this where it's going? And his hair's very well groomed and always in immaculate condition.
Yeah, so it can't
and
be
then
anything else.
Like, oh no, that's the focus.
Yeah.
That's the focus here. Yeah.
That
he'd gone bald and he lost all confidence whatsoever. And suddenly his kicking stats plummeted. His play plummeted. He was suddenly playing atrociously and dropped out of the national team because he was bald.
Because he was bald.
And like Samson, his hair, his power is entirely in his hair.
Exactly. But, you know, since growing it back, he'd regrown his confidence, got back his mojo, he'd learned to kick again. It's a really inspiring story, and presumably he told all of this on the day of the final.
I think so.
that with great hair comes great kicking ability.
The rest of them will go around and start talking about, you know, I'm doing this for my mum who passed away 3 years ago. And, you know, or I'm doing this, you know, in order to make my father proud who never believed in me, but I really want to show him I'm worth believing in. Then Didier Camembert-Barbera goes, you know, guys, it's really tough to say, but I'm actually
You can say it, Didier, you can say it. Yeah. Oh, it's a good thing he had a really supportive team behind him.
That same interview where he talked about his wife being pregnant and talking about it for the first time and so on.
Mm-hmm.
He then says, I'm really disappointed we lost the final, even though I felt I personally outplayed John Kerwin.
My man, I love that level of confidence. If he was bald, he'd never have said that with a full head of hair.
He never said that.
He is balls out. My man, Camembert-Barbera. You big yourself up, my man.
But I love that he said that 30 years later, he's still clinging to that.
Yeah,
Kerwin scored the winning try.
I showed him.
Yeah.
I showed him that day. As I say, there's two sides to this, right? Because what I was going to say was that one side, again, it's funny that he came out as bald. The other side is, I think it's really cool that a top-level athlete has spoken about being image conscious.
Yeah.
Because, like, especially male rugby players are all so, like, brazen and just, like, really unable to talk about that kind of a thing. And are really, like, you know, they have to be like, oh, I don't care about that kind of thing. I'm just naturally gorgeous. What are you on about? I think it's really cool that an international rugby player was like, actually, I was really, really conscious about the way I looked. And then, actually, I worked on it. And I felt good in myself. And I felt positive about my... I was going to use the phrase body positive. I don't think that's the correct phrase to use. But I felt positive in myself. And I then became a better rugby player as a result. And I think that's a cool thing that he's openly spoken about.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. Like, without Didier Camembert-Ebbera, does Gavin Henson happen?
Exactly.
And probably also, not. Like, I highly relate as someone whose hairline is starting to recede.
Oh,
like,
man.
As someone who knows their days are ticking, you know, I get it. I get it, man. As someone whose hair is currently so long and shaggy because I know it's the last chance I'm going to have, you know? So, yes, the game is kicked off by this point. France have done a big scrum.
Yep.
And Grant Fox does an unbelievable Gary Owen.
Oh,
he hangs it in the air. And you think that's a kind of pointless kick and it's not hitting anything. And then not only does it kind of completely evade Blanco, it bounces perfectly 1 meter out from touch.
Yeah. And Blanco's convinced it goes dead, but I think the touch judge correctly calls it's just before touch. But you're right, it completely bamboozles the French backfield. They have no idea how to defend something like that because it's just such an inconvenient kick. And it doesn't matter that there's no one from New Zealand chasing it because it's going to be such a difficult thing because you know it's going to bounce 3 miles into the air or straight into touch. Like, there's no easy way of dealing with that kick if you don't catch it on the full, which was so difficult to do. So, yeah, it's just a brilliant start to the game by Fox.
And because this was before all lineups being brought back to 5 meters, it means France have to throw in 1 inch out from their own try line.
Yeah.
Like,
horrible.
Basically on the line. And before lifting lineouts, if New Zealand steal this, they flop over and they've scored.
Yeah.
This is enormous pressure on in about the third minute.
Yeah.
And you're on edge here, and somehow Jean Condom secures it. Somehow he keeps it safe. Jean Condom keeps it safe. But under enormous pressure.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said, it keeps going. They keep the pressure on. Like, there's a point where France, I think, knock it on a few phases later, or maybe it's after another attack. And there's a point...
Grant Fox goes himself and gets turned over.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a point where... Keith gets really excited on the commentary and goes, "It's the lefto move!" As they run lefto in the final. Doesn't quite work out.
Say what you like about Keith Quinn, but that man loves lefto.
He certainly does love lefto. And I imagine he's partial to the odd righto.
Yeah, I mean, he's okay with righto, but lefto's where it's at, man.
Lefto is where it's at. It's on the left. Yeah.
After about almost 10 minutes, right, the first... three rucks out of three. In 10 minutes, there's three rucks. All of them are blown as unplayable.
Yeah.
And so begins my irritation with Kerry Fitzgerald, the referee, right?
Okay.
And I have a policy on the channel and so on of not talking about refereeing and not complaining about refereeing
because I
think it's bullshit and boring. But I think there's a statute of limitations for me of 25 years. And after 25 years, you're okay to complain about the referee.
I will also preface this, you know, with... I presume you're not about to say, oh, we had a shit game, France were robbed. I presume that's not what you're about to say.
I think there's two issues here, right? One is he gives New Zealand such a rub of the green, as it were. New Zealand get an awful lot of luck until about the last 10, 15 minutes, at which point they've wrapped it up. Like, okay, so France's first penalty awarded to them is in the 38th minute.
That's absurd.
Yeah, there's a few times in which they really should have had one. There's a few, like, real stat... Like, there's one ruck where New Zealand just go over and take Babezier out as he's about to play the ball.
Yeah.
And instead, New Zealand are given the penalty.
Buck Shelford does stamp on Ebani at one point. But then again, he's Buck Shelford. I wouldn't point him out and say, you're penalised, mate. Like,
oh, no, of course
I can forgive him for that one.
Sure. But also, my God, does he blow everything up as unplayable? Like, there are points at which the ball is basically in the scrum half's hands and he blows up as unplayable for a scrum.
There's a few silly ones of that. Yeah. And what I really liked as well...
enormously frustrating.
So, constantly, off the back of scrums and rucks, so New Zealand, rightfully, were wanting to give loads and loads of ball to Buck Shelford. And Buck Shelford was clearly very much targeted by... You'd think this sentence is going to end with Daniel Dobrovka, one of the big lads. Pierre Bezier was absolutely manhandling the biggest man on the field. And I have so much respect for that, because at the back of scrums, every time Kirk was saying, Shelford, you carry into Bezier, you're three times his size, you're the strongest man in this World Cup, go for it. And Bezier was just going around his legs and being an absolute pest every single time. And there's one point in the second half where Bezier's clearly been going at him all day. There's a point where Bezier chops him and Shelford drops the ball and kind of picks it back up again. The referee blows it and Shelford looks so insanely pissed off that he just like lobs the ball at the ground or something, or shoves somebody. And there's a point again after that where he gets penalised because I think he gets up and tries crawling along the floor or something, because he just does not want to accept the fact that a smaller man is getting under his skin. And again, like, You can sympathise with Shelford, right? Because he's not used to this. He's not used to getting bullied by somebody smaller than him. Because he's not only a massive number eight, but he's one of the best players in the world.
Yeah.
And
one of the hardest men to ever live.
That's it. And he does have a great game here as well, Shelford. But Bezier does such an unbelievable job as a nine playing against an eight. That the size difference of what is expected of that kind of a clash is not something that's massively changed in the last 35 years. And Bezier was world class at that, at dealing with Shelford.
It's used before used, isn't it?
Mm.
That, like, dropping big men quickly, knowing exactly what to do, no matter what, that, like, never allowing yourself to die or concede.
100%. Yeah. I guess that's it, probably. There was probably a coach of junior rugby in South Africa at that point said, you know what? What if that, but the scrum half's big and strong? And then, as you say, along comes Yeerst. Like, it was a fantastic performance all round by Bezier, to kind of preface that. I'm going to talk a lot about how good he was. But, yes.
And I'm afraid that is kind of a cliffhanger. We're splitting this into two parts because we went on for very close to 3 hours. In fact, we recorded for more than 3 hours. And so we're going to split this in half. The next part will go up on Monday as we get into the rest of the World Cup final from 1987. And also talk through our Dick of the Day, our Man of the Match, as well as revealing which World Cup we'll be doing next, which the next series will be dedicated to. Please join us in a few days for that on the Monday if you're listening as this goes up. If not, and it's already past the last Monday in September, then grand, it's probably going to autoplay after this anyway, so there's no point listening to me talk on beyond this. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you in a few days' time for part two.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.